Welcome to today's sixth CEU seminar called Setting Ethical Expectations in Mental Health Agencies. I'll be your presenter for today's seminar, and my name's Michelle Sparks. I'm the owner and director of River of Life Professional Counseling, a private practice here in suburban Columbus, Ohio. This ethics seminar is pre-approved by the State of Ohio Counselor, Social Worker, and Marriage and Family Therapist Board through provider River of Life Professional Counseling. It is pre-approved for licensed professional counselors, licensed professional clinical counselors, and supervising counselors in the State of Ohio, as well as licensed social workers, licensed independent social workers, and supervising counselors in the State of Ohio. Also, this seminar does meet the requirements for ethics for the State of Ohio for continuing education. So I know we have to take courses on ethics, and I know they tend to be on the dry side. After years of doing this, sometimes we feel like, oh gosh, here we go again, you know, learning the same kind of ethical foundations. But the foundation that I'm hoping to lay today in terms of setting ethical expectations in mental health agencies is the idea that we can be more proactive in terms of consideration of ethical standards, of the way we think, of the way we approach potential ethical issues in a mental health setting. I think sometimes we tend to get into this mindset of almost like trying to memorize ethical standards, making decisions, and, you know, you do this, you don't do this, as opposed to setting an ambiance in our office or our practice setting or the agency we work for or our interactions with the clients proactively, which basically gives a foundation for ethical expectations. So I like to start this seminar by talking about setting up an ethical climate. Yes, we can set up an ethical climate in advance in how we're doing things. For example, how we arrange the initial phone call and scheduling can be the very first start of setting up that ethical climate. Do we, by the way we speak and engage with that client on the phone, do we set up a welcoming atmosphere? The idea, I want to hear your personal narrative about what your presenting concerns are. Help me understand you. Help me listen to you. I'm not saying we offer free counseling on the phone or free crisis services, but the warmth, the Rogers process variables can begin even in that initial phone call. I think that really can set up a good expectation for them. It can also show them a sense of our competency. When I have clients that call in and ask, do you deal with potential clients with such and such issue? What would you do? To hear from me some ideas about techniques, what's medically, appropriate or according to the medical model, what's efficacious, helps that person who's calling in realize that, you know, I know something about what they're talking about and I'm hearing their narrative, and that throughout when we do meet, we'll talk further, we'll individualize our treatment standards, but that I'm aware of the different sorts of options that are out there. It gives a welcoming idea. It gives a first impression. And we really can't minimize that idea of the importance of first impressions. Our policies and procedures is another way we can set up an ethical climate. It's really important, and I encourage you, if you have a chance, to review the policies and procedures paperwork for your agency, wherever you work. Is it specific about what constitutes a client and therapist relationship? Does it clarify for a client what a counselor is and is not what your roles will entail in terms of diagnosis and treatment of mental health, and what it won't entail? Does it speak to issues like the length of the session and the fees? What happens if they're late, or any consequences if they don't give notice of a certain time frame about cancellation? Does it talk about things like insurance billing or self-pay? What about the nature of your agency? For example, if you're not a crisis-based agency, what happens if a client does get in a crisis? It's important on your phone message, as well as in the paperwork, as many different ways as you can highlight it, say you're not a crisis agency, what directions are you giving this person for if they were to get in a crisis? We just want to make sure both our policies and procedures in writing, the things we're saying when we meet face to face with a client, the nonverbals, every interaction we have with them, again, just reiterates the same foundations, the same structure, the same dynamics of the ethics in the therapeutic alliance. We have this term in ethics called informed consent. Basically, the idea is, what does the client think he or she's getting versus what we've conveyed? What do we think they're getting? Are we on the same page? So a lot of times our clients may have an idea what constitutes quote-unquote counseling or mental health services at the agency that you're at. And it's really important to make sure that they don't just go through and sign or put an initial on the paperwork without reading or understanding. On my paperwork for my policies and procedures at the bottom, it says, I have read, understood, and agreed to the above, which means we have to give an opportunity to ask them if they have questions, if they need accommodation and understanding that we will clarify further, whether that's reading out loud policies and procedures, whether that's clarifying terms or something that someone doesn't understand, or when certain conditions apply. We need to reinforce also not just what's in writing, but we need to reinforce it through our behaviors. And periodically, we may want to revisit the policies and the ethics of the organization for which we're working. Our documentation also needs to show that we are in line with what we've conveyed in writing and in behaviors. There should be congruency across the board. The other thing, in terms of creating an ethical environment, is making sure we always have a network of colleagues that we can go to about things for consultation. So whether it's while you're developing forms, how you're dealing with certain types of clients in the clinical setting, or whatever, Lord, that you need to make sure that you have that collegial support. That's what will constitute a scope of practice. If ever you're called out on the rug, say a client makes an allegation, whether it's true or not, that collegial support is going to be important. Also, the thing I like to convey today in today's seminar is the importance of being proactive in terms of setting an ethical climate. All of us should have liability insurance if we're dealing with our clients and in the mental health field. Now, granted, depending your function and your agency, it might be your agency that holds a liability insurance company, you know, policy for you. So maybe you haven't been aware of that. But it's important to know what that is. It's important if you work for, say, a community agency, maybe ask some questions to understand. But I can guarantee someone has you covered by a liability policy. If you're in private practice, you know that in order to be on insurance panels, there's a minimum of a $1 to $3 million coverage. It's important to know that when you have cases that are ambiguous or you think there might be a threat or an ethical question, that you can make use and you should make use of calling the liability company. That's why you have them. And in some states and in some situations, they will ask you if there's a possible allegation of misconduct. Did you discuss with colleagues or your state board? Have you talked to the liability insurance company if you had any sense that something might be off with a given client? And then finally, when we're talking about setting up an ethical climate, we're talking about knowing the mission of your organization. That's really important because we want to convey the goals, the warmth, the mission of the agency and make sure we're behaving in a congruent way with that. Now, there are different terms you might hear when you're looking at things in terms of types of ethics. There's mandatory ethics, and then there's another term called aspirational ethics. Mandatory ethics are the non-negotiable ethics, the minimal standards. Things, for example, like you just don't have sex with a client, period. There is no situation where you could argue that it's advantageous or necessary or not harmful in a position of power to do that. So mandatory ethics. Aspirational ethics might be a little more ambiguous in terms of there's more of a judgment call about what constitutes what's called best practices. The key in the literature is what they call intentionality. And so when something goes to the board, that's what they're looking at too. What way were you thinking and reasoning? What was your intention? So it would be impossible to justify if you, for example, had a sexual relationship with a client that your intentionality was good, that because they had a bad relationship with their spouse and needed to be loved and have a certain type of intimacy, that you were the one that had to do that. That would be a pretty clear-cut case. But oftentimes you run into cases that are more ambiguous on the continuum. Things where our clients who are coming in because they are hurting and have certain presenting concerns may interpret our actions, our words, or things a certain way, whether we intended them that way or not. And so that's where we have to look at what's the intentionality. Let's say on the continuum, we're not talking about a sexual relationship, but let's say someone's grieving because a family member close to them died suddenly, and they're escalated in a session. If you give them a side hug and pat them on the shoulder, the board might want to look at, okay, what's your intentionality? Was it comfort in the midst of grief? Was there another way to show that through your words, through the therapeutic dialogue? Did they need that hug? Could that client have interpreted or misinterpreted that hug? So intentionality is important. I love this quote regarding ethics because oftentimes we think of, oh, just tell me what to do. What should I do in such and such situation? And we know that every situation with our clients is rather different and it's not just a linear type of thing. So this quote I always read and include because I really think it gives us a good way of conceptualizing ethics. Codes of ethics do not come to professions on stone tablets from high mountains. Rather, they're always a work in progress. They're developed by committees, examined by professionals and the public they serve, and then lived out by frail humans and adapted to changing contexts. Besides people sometimes saying they feel frustrated because of the ethical codes and trying to make sure they're complying with everything or initial people who are just starting out in the field being nervous, We might wonder, what are the codes of ethics good for? They are definitely good for something. So it's not just to make people afraid of getting in trouble, but they actually do give some specific guidance. It helps professionals keep their colleagues accountable. So looking at, you know, what are people in our fields doing? Looking at what the realistic scope of practice is, would most people in a similar setting with a similar group of clients do what you have done or might do? And finally, keep in mind that when we're talking about ethics, we're not just talking about our behavior, but we're talking about what is conveyed to the public. The board is not necessarily there to protect you, defend you, and cheer for you about what you're doing. They're there to make sure that the public has guidance and outlines regarding what should be expected in terms of the welfare of the clients. Now, why are people afraid of ethical codes? Well, like I said, situations often are not just simply linear. Oftentimes, they're much more complex in reality. It's not just that straightforward. Otherwise, you wouldn't be having such a discussion and debate and process about whether or not something's ethical. The context matters. If you're working with someone who's had layers and layers of grief and trauma and needs comfort, that might be different than working with someone who has another issue. Working with someone who's been traumatized by sexual abuse, sitting close to them or patting them on the shoulder to reassure may really feel threatening to them versus someone who's not gone through abuse. So context can really matter. The agency's mission, values, and focus also make a difference. That's something that's important, looking at what is the agency's mission, but also what is my job description. What is it that I'm really expected to do in my job? If it's diagnosis and treatment of mental health disorders, if it's linkage to community resources, if it's conducting groups or disseminating education, it's very important to be congruent with what is expected of me. Am I operating within the guidelines of what the client thinks he or she is coming to therapy for, and what is what my title, what my job title, what my function is at that agency? That's the key. So, for example, in my situation, I realize that I'm a independently licensed counseling clinician in a private practice setting. I'm not a crisis manager, as I was at one time with inpatient or with community mental health. I'm not a case manager, but I can refer someone, like I did the other day, who needed linkage to services. It is certainly ethically appropriate when I realize there's something that needs to be provided that I don't provide at my agency to link them to another agency that does that. One of the things that's a challenge for a lot of people with ethics is that we don't always understand why certain ethical decisions have been made. That, you know, we get these changes every now and then. You might get the emails from the state board about the updates, but we don't always understand why. The other thing that's challenging, if you look at the updates from the board about who's had ethical violations, the application of rules is not universal. You could have two people who have a boundary violation, for example, and one has to take an extra ethical course, and the other one has to go through 2 years of professional counseling with a non-independent license until they can gain their independent license back. So it's not just linear. There's so many differences. One of the things I think is interesting is that when we talk about proactively setting up things for ethical behavior, that a lot of what constitutes a healthy foundation isn't always even these deep legal types of things that we're thinking about. That's why I included this list from Bragan. Granted, it's a 2008 article, but I think it highlights some of what makes what we do effective. He talks about every session, making sure you welcome the client with an attitude of kindness and authentic, genuine, empathic concern and understanding. We can't get away from this concept of empathy. No matter in this room how many different theoretical orientations people have or how they might approach their therapy with a given client, one of the things that probably all of us have in common is that foundation of believing about the empathy and Rogers process variables. There may be articles out there about the pros and cons of using different therapeutic approaches, but I don't know that in the years I've done this, in 25 years, that I've ever seen an article, a book, a comment that said that empathy was harmful. This same guy also talks about showing, quote, true empathy. So we want to make sure it's genuine. I mean, the clients can pick up on that. We also want to make sure it's in an atmosphere of trust. It's welcoming. It's sincere. I ask my clients off the bat, the first session, have you ever been to clinical counseling before? And I elicit, you know, their response about what they liked or didn't like about their past therapy, what they think therapy is or is not, because that's important to me to know what it is they're looking for. Sometimes I have clients who aren't sure what therapy is, but someone's told them you need therapy because you're going through something in your life. You need someone outside the situation to go to. So finding out, you know, what that's going to be for them, it also gives me a chance to reassure them that they made a risky decision of coming to talk to someone that they don't know about their stuff, and that takes a step of courage. That's where I can demonstrate that true empathy. I've had a few new clients in the last week. I've had to really affirm and say to them, you know, wow, it takes courage. It takes a step to talk with someone outside. And I appreciate you exercising that courage to come here to talk. I want to assure you that my effort is to create a safe, comfortable place here where we can work through those things. And sometimes just saying that and then them seeing the atmosphere, the physical atmosphere, it feeling like a living room setting with sofas and pillows and just, you know, comfortable, that the atmosphere, the office is neat, it's professional, really conveys something of a welcoming atmosphere. The other thing that Bragan in his article talks about is making sure that ethical and professional standards are an expected part of our interactions with the client. So it's not just when things seem to be breaking apart. It's not just when we have rifts in communication, but that this is just part of what we do every session, whether it's giving them the paperwork, whether it's managing our use of time in the session, whether it's choosing which issues to broach in a given session versus which ones to table for later, whether it's de-escalating a client on certain issues or reframing and refocusing them toward other issues. One of the other things that promotes ethical behavior is commenting on concerns in a timely manner. If there is a concern, it's better if we bring it up in a timely manner than later trying to do something that is just a haphazard patching up of it and trying to deal with it after time has passed. We want to, again, hear the client's narrative. So call attention to the situations by asking the client to tell his or her story regarding any areas that we want clarification in. Cultivate the sense of the entire personhood of the client, not just the mental health issues, but hearing the context in which the mental health issues are occurring. I think the tendency for most of us professionals is to hyper-focus on the mental health issues because if a client's coming in saying, I'm depressed, my life is awful, I'm stressed out, this relationship is struggling, my job is on the fritz. We tend to hyper-focus on that, but it's important to really just hear the narrative because that can provide some context too. We need to frame things as assisting the client and shaping, helping, and making productive decisions about clinical issues. Again, we're talking about a therapeutic partnership. We're not talking about an expert clinician just imposing things on a client. We're talking about someone coming in because they have concerns, and we're going to figure it out together. We want to not convey over-the-top optimism nor pessimism. So we really want to be balanced in terms of how we present things. And it's important that when we talk about ethics, we're not just talking about our clients and concerns about him or her, but we're self-evaluating. We may not always be the best judge about our behavior and how it's coming across. So that's where it's important to make sure there is supervision. Even if you're an independently licensed counselor or social worker in Ohio and you feel like, oh, I've been doing this for decades, I don't really, quote, need supervision, the fact is we're all to some degree blinded to some of the areas that we may need to be held accountable for. One of the other things that can be very welcoming and helpful in terms of a foundation that promotes ethical behavior is to make sure we reframe our role as clinician, as partner, helper, and facilitator rather than just expert. What I like to do with clients is help remind them that I'm one of many options and resources they have. I remember years ago a client going through a certain issue and coming to me and they were just feeling really down and out. And after a few sessions, after we began counseling, they came in and their demeanor was much more upbeat. They said certain life circumstances had changed, certain resources they had access to that they didn't before. And they said, wow, they said, you know, so we talked about what was the role of counseling going to be now after the third or fourth session when certain things in their life changed. And they said, you know, would you mind if I made use of this thing at my church or at my job or did this? And I said, you know, I'm one part of the puzzle. I'm one option. And I hope that, you know, you and other clients will also make use of the resources, you know, and that we're building the support systems and various ways in your life. And I remember that client saying, you know, they were concerned that they didn't want me to feel bad if I wasn't the one who gave them the solution that totally changed their life around. And I said, you know, the goal is you being able to cope better and stuff with the certain presenting concerns you came in with. And if that happens because of some things we did here, and then also because of some things happening elsewhere, I'm happy for you. So reminding our clients that while they come to us, we're also affirming the various ways that they can address their presenting concern. We also want to remain calm and attentive and professional, even when there's an emergency. And make sure they're aware of what the crisis procedures are. One thing I think that's important to look at when we're talking about setting ethical expectations in mental health agencies is this concept of values. Now, I know there was a time years ago where we shied away from even talking about values. The whole idea was, gosh, don't mention values, don't talk about it, don't... And I will qualify this by saying our goal is not to dictate values for the client. not to make judgments on the client's values, not to impose our values on them, but values do influence the nature of the therapeutic relationship. When we talk about therapy being multiculturally competent, the fact is all of us have many layers to us. Our worldview and culture, our interpretations of things, they just color how we approach the presenting concerns, the solutions to those concerns, our interpersonal relationships, and our mindset on a bunch of things. So when we're talking about values, we're talking about someone's worldview, their culture, their understanding of the world, their ideas about what sickness is and what health is, about whether counseling is useful or not, about whether instead of counseling, maybe you go to community members, or you go to friends, or go to your church, or your family members. Values also impact our interpretations about what is good or bad, what is joyous or painful. Values are based on our evaluation of an event, our emotional reaction, and our life experience. So that's why I say it's so important to hear a client's narrative. Values are so deeply ingrained. They start from our family of origin, the narratives through the years. And while I might not always hold the same values as my clients, it's fascinating for me to understand how they came to what they're saying their worldview is. They have had some emotional reactions to some certain parts of their lives that have been more salient for them. They have had life experiences that have pushed them a little more in one direction or the other. They may have made some decisions over time, for example, about who are their role models, who are their heroes, who do they want to hear opinions from, who would they rather stay away from them. These are things that are important to us to hear in terms of being ethical. Because the fact of the matter is, the number one thing the literature says that we do, that clients like, that helps them perceive us as competent, is when we're sincere. So with values, again, we're talking about multicultural considerations. It could be what topics are or are not discussed. Fact of the matter is, most literature says that if we're not sure, it's important to ask and see about broaching topics. Because we don't want to either assume that definitely a topic is important or that it's not. The considerations are what topics will or won't be addressed in counseling. I realize there's some things I don't know a lot about. For example, when I have kids and teens come to me, wow, that know all these apps and technology and certain things, there's a degree to which I know because I have kids that are into some of that too. But there's another degree where I'm like, oh, okay, teach me. Tell me more about that. Oh, how's that important in your life? So I think the main key is making sure we allow room for that to happen. Values also can impact treatment goals. Remember, there's some people out there, they're coming to counseling, but they're still coming not convinced that counseling is their answer. So we have to respect that. Values also impact how people measure the outcomes of whether therapy is successful or not. I like asking the question directly to clients, how will we know when we've achieved what you've come for, when things are quote unquote better, what will be happening? Now, I've listed in the next few PowerPoint slides some value-laden topics. And my hope is that as we read through these or as you go through them, maybe that you would do an exercise for yourself about when you think of these words, what comes to mind? Is there a judgment about right versus wrong? Is there a moral or ethical side of it? Is there I don't really want to broach this issue? Is there anxiety? You know, because any of these things could become an issue for our clients or for us. And what happens in particular when you have certain values on any one of these topics we're going to get into versus your client's value? Let's take, for example, the topic abortion. What if you are very pro-life and your client's coming in after finding out they're pregnant and they didn't want to be pregnant and their boyfriend or significant other is having a certain decision or they're having a certain decision they're trying to sort through? It's interesting when you have one point of view and your client may have a different one. What about things like adoption? Topics like assisted suicide. That's a tricky one because, you know, again, our goal is to do what's beneficial and not harmful. Our goal is to keep people alive. Our goal is to, when we see risk factors, assess for risk factors, harm to self, harm to others. But then you hear people, you know, having their own opinions about this. I remember when I worked at a psych hospital doing an assessment on a guy who basically was like, you know, yeah, I might be pink slipped or involuntarily committed here now. He's like, but the best thing you or anyone else could do for me would be to give me a bottle of pills so I could kill myself right now. Obviously, I'm not going to do that. I had to highlight with him the importance of being focused on keeping people alive and giving them the coping skills to deal with things. But I mean, that was where he was at. He made it very clear to me that even after the assessment process and beginning therapy back on the unit where I used to work, that his mindset, at least at that time, was that when he gets released, he still wants someone to help him die, that he does not have optimism about approaching life. So that was something very clearly that I communicated with my colleagues about, the nurses, the doctor, the other staff that were dealing with him. But again, we may have clients who say, not that we should assist anyone in suicide, but what I'm saying, you might even have a worldview saying, you know what, if I knew I had a terminal diagnosis, I don't know that I'd want to live. You know, these, again, this is where topics are not always as just linear as we make them. What about things like birth control? You might think, oh, well, it's not my place to tell someone about what to do about that, which is true, but you may have clients that have a strong opinion any which way on that topic. I've had clients that don't believe in ever using birth control and have had multitudes of kids and not been able to financially support them, but needed counseling for the family system. And I had to be present for them, helping link them to services and stuff regardless. And knowing that birth control wasn't going to be one of their thoughts or options or consideration. Let's take in the last few years, what about the topic of COVID? Wow, I mean, I can tell you at least at my practice, that's been a hot button issue. I've had so many clients that have had anxiety themselves or even in interacting with their relatives about use of masks or no masks, if people should be vaccinated or not, what the rules are, can certain things be mandated, can they not. I've even had people come in that were in part related to their presenting concerns, trying to decide if they wanted to stay in a job or not because their employer was saying that they were mandating vaccines, or if not, the people who were not vaccinated had to do additional procedures and they felt discriminated against. So this whole issue of COVID and the approach that people have is one that is a value-laden topic. again, we have to be careful. Our role is not to lecture people or to pro or con or support or agree or disagree on these topics. But you may have clients coming in that have pretty strong opinions on them. And to be able to make sure that we're still able to be empathic enough to meet them in their narrative. Things like custody issues. Let me be clear that our roles and functions as licensed counselors or licensed social workers are not ever to make a decision about this child should be with parent A or parent B. That is a forensic role that is supposed to be relegated to someone in the court system, a forensic psychologist, a guardian ad litem, a judge. So we don't make comments about, I mean, you may have within yourself an opinion after meeting or interacting with people, but the fact is our role is diagnosis and treatment of mental health disorders in whatever setting you're in. So if you have a release to consult with someone, you can say, oh, this child has a diagnosis of depression, you know, and you can give the facts and details of their treatment plan if you wish. You can explain, you know, the depression and the types of thoughts they're having. You can speak to the treatment approaches you're using. But if you go to court, you're not supposed to make comments about, oh, I think little Johnny's depressed because his dad is a horrible parent or his mom doesn't do this. We're not making comments about causation or determination of that. That could really get you to an unethical place and an ethical violation. So we have to be very clear and very careful because that is one of those areas where we could be treading a thin line. What about other value-laden topics like discipline of children, death and dying, or dealing with disabilities? Things like gang membership, prejudices, political views, racism, identity like sexual identity, sexual practices, suicide or unwed pregnancies. You know, again, instantly when I just read these, there's some type of reaction you have inside. And some of these you might think, well, shoot, that's not a value topic. That's just a whatever, you know. Everybody should have the same rights in this area. But for some people, it is a value topic because our clients have their ways of thinking about these things. We have our ways. And so, again, we have to make sure, are we able on a basic level to remain empathic with this client? So when we're talking about ethical dilemmas, before we get into specific types of ethical issues, I want to share with you some of the different ethical decision-making approaches. So you have these as we go through the issues today. So why is something even an ethical dilemma? Well, because oftentimes we do have competing ethical standards to consider in our decision-making. There are conflicts between ethics, laws, and legalities. Just because someone has certain rules in a given setting doesn't mean that in another setting that it's not different. So there's so many layers of complexities that we need to consider. It's not just an easy, straightforward application of standards. We have our professionally mandated ethics. We have our personal morals and beliefs, and we have philosophical morals, just ideas about, quote, the way life should be. Now, there's six general ethical principles that for years have been in the literature that are going to be things that the board will look at. If there's an ethical complaint or concern, undeniably, these are the things that are going to be considered. Autonomy. Have you allowed an opportunity for some self-determination of the client and their individual decision-making? I mean, that we're not imposing something on him or her, that there is room for choice within reasonable, healthy choices. Maleficence. We're making sure that we're avoiding harm. Beneficence. we're doing good, we're benefiting, we're helping. Justice, we're being fair. Fidelity, we're keeping promises, we're honest. And veracity, we're truthful with everybody in the mix. In terms of problem-solving models, we can approach, one of the ways we can approach ethics is to just use a straightforward problem-solving model, just like you would in your day-to-day life. What's the problem? That could be the first step where we have a difference of opinion, where there's an ethical concern. Maybe the client sees the problem as one thing, you see it as another. Maybe the client sees, oh, the problem is this dumb court's on my back and they just want to blame me. They think I'm one of those people. And maybe you're seeing the problem is you're a danger to your kids. You're using drugs around them. So are we identifying the problem, and what happens when our client sees the problem as one thing versus we see it as another? Then defining goals by looking at various sources, generating various courses of action, and considering the possible consequences of each action. Then processing how well it's gone later. One of the approaches I like, just because it's very comprehensive, is called the four quadrant approach of Foster and Black. They look at the quadrant of ethics and justice. This is pretty much what we typically think of as ethics. So the board standards of ethics, principles that we commonly see in terms of counselor and client interactions, counselor education. We look at legalities. What is lawful? What can be prosecuted criminally or civilly? The third quadrant is personal variables. How do we deal with things like stress, self-care? How do we maintain well-being? So, I mean, obviously the work we're doing can bring stress. How do we keep a balance in our life and reduce compassion fatigue? What about the fourth quadrant, that of morals, which is our personal sense of what's right for the counselor? Again, this may greatly differ between what a client thinks. I'll give you an example here. I remember years ago, I had a couple come in. When they called me, they said, we're coming in because there's been an issue of infidelity and we want help trying to deal with this rift in our relationship. That's not an unusual request. I've had several couples having to deal with that issue. When they came in, they shared with me that they had met over 20 years ago and within a few days of meeting, moved in with each other, but that they have an open marriage, that throughout the years that they've both had multiple partners, and that's been their agreement. Personally, that's not a value or belief I have or something I would do. So I remember bringing up with my colleagues in our, you know, staff meetings and stuff about this, and making sure to keep myself in check, because I thought, oh boy, you know. And so I looked at, okay, how do I, without getting into the issue of them, of the rightness, wrongness, or just values about open marriages or not, how do I help them deal with the fears about the future of their relationship, the distrust, the betrayal, and the different feelings they were feeling about this affair? Because even though they had chosen to have various relationships and have an open marriage, for some reason this last situation seemed to be more frustrating to them than any of the past ones. And in the past they described a situation where even for 1 to 2 years at a time they would maybe even move in with another partner or be interacting, dating, having intimacies with the other partner, and then get back together with each other. And that it wasn't out of the norm for them to do that. But this time, something about it really bothered them. So that was interesting. So again, I didn't get into a discussion with them about, oh, I don't like this, you know, you shouldn't do this to begin with. You know, I might have my own opinion about it, but we just talked about, you know, what for them was different about this round, and then talked about operational definitions like, how do the two of them define things like trust or distrust, betrayal, openness in the relationship, honesty? What does that look like? And what was different about the scenario? So there's other models out there I wanted to make you aware of in terms of making ethical judgments. There's an integrated model, and I'm going to spell this guy's last name. I would call it Tarvidas, but it's T-A-R-V-Y-D-A-S. Tarvidas has an integrated model. Why it's called integrated, that he looks at these six principles we talked about before, the autonomy, beneficence, maleficence, justice, and those others. He looks at the virtues, like virtue ethics, but he also is well known for considering the context of things. When you meet with the board, if you have someone accuse you of an ethical violation, you'll want to make sure that the context is considered, that if the context is being considered, that you're able to tell the board, I'm using the Tarvidas integrated model. I'm considering the context of A, B, and C. They may want to know how you came to your decision about things. There's an intersection of the thought patterns of what you think might be a good choice at a given time, and then the rules, the emotions. There's a sense of, well, what intuitively is right or wrong. So basically with the Tarvidas contextual integrated model, again, we're kind of combining those basic principles of ethics as well as the context. And then we're using what they call a good reasoned approach. We're looking at what if. So Tarvidas in his integrated model highlights being reflective, being balanced between all issues and parties. So for example, if you're talking with the board and saying, I'm using the Tarvidas integrated model with this client situation, they're going to also look at what would the client maybe be saying are the contextual considerations. How is a client processing these principles of autonomy, beneficence, non-maleficence, you know? And the other thing that the Tarvidas model highlights is the importance of collaboration, the therapeutic alliance, that there is something in the dynamic between the counselor and the client. And that's highlighted in terms of ethical decision making. There's another model that's talked about in the literature, and this is by Cotone, C-O-T-T-O-N-E. It's Cotone's social constructivism model. Cotone talks about what is it that's understood in the clinical therapeutic relationship, that there's some kind of shared experience that we as the clinician and the client have. And it's all about how we constructed that experience. What is our mutual understanding? How do we label things? For example, the narrative. That aspect of language is so important. If my client believes that everybody out there who's a helper is, quote, a doctor, even if I'm saying I'm a counselor, I help people decide and problem solve and give them skills to cope with their life, they may still keep seeing me as a doctor and may want to call me doctor over and over, because that's in their mind what you call someone who's gone to school for years and is, quote, an expert. It's the social aspect of language. The idea in the Cotone social constructivism model is that there's no single socially constructed outcome. We're looking at consensus building. What would most people say? So we're looking at gathering information. We're looking at negotiated definitions. The nature of the relationship of the clinician and the client. What most of our colleagues would say. An example in the literature that they used was a case of child circumcision. And it was interesting. This case went on for years and years, but it was looking at the clinician filed a report with the local children's services organization saying that this child was in danger because in the child's native country, the parents were intending to bring the child there for a child circumcision procedure, and that the child should not be allowed to go back to their home country with the parents knowing this procedure was going to happen, that it was an issue of, quote, abuse and harm willfully to a child. So then you have the issue of culture, the issue that the child circumcision was not abnormal for that country or that culture. So this went back and forth quite a bit. Initially, there was not consensus among the agencies about this. But what they looked at in the long run, the final ultimate ruling was that this child was suffering from trauma and fear of anticipating this procedure, was scared, was having nightmares, was distrustful of the parents, and the idea being also the other thing that ended up in the final ruling after a lot of back and forth was that the family, even in spite of their country of origin rules, was now residing in the U.S. and that in the U.S. laws, so again, not even so much ethics as much as the U.S. law, that it was considered abusive for this to occur and that it was adding to the child's mental and emotional stress as well as would be considered physical trauma to the child. So the final court that ended up hearing the case ended up, because of where the case was occurring, basically on a legal level, deciding based on the state that they were in, the legalities of where this occurred here, and the effect on the mental health of the child. So the child wasn't pulled from the home, wasn't anything like that, which was a possibility at one point in this case, but in the long run, the child was just not allowed to go with the parents for the procedure overseas, that they had to stay here. So again, this is challenging because that brings home the non-linear nature of these cases. You know, how do we be respectful to the whole culture and values of any given person or client, but then also, you know, when there's an issue possibly of harm to self, harm to others, you know, it can be challenging. And many of the cases, when I was looking and preparing this seminar, it was fascinating to me that most of the cases that are cited in the ethics literature go back and forth even for months and years, and initially might be ruled one way, then somebody overrules it, then a third person overrules that, and it could be 1 or 2 years before the final ruling's decided. And it just goes home to say, again, the legal institutions and the boards, the people making the ethics decisions, don't always agree with each other. Oftentimes we're talking about being reactionary to certain situations. So that's why I wanted to present, how can we be proactive? So one of the things that all the ethics types of, frameworks have in common are some basic considerations. Things that you can ask yourself when you're going through cases. Is there anything significant about this case? What are the immediate concerns? What are the long-term issues or potential issues? What do I need as I work with this person? Is this case within my scope of practice or should I refer it? What's my heart telling me? Do I have any approach avoidance kinds of issues? Have I waited to get any necessary information if I'm not sure? I would say the number one thing I would encourage you to pay attention to, because I've witnessed this in working with people who have had alleged violations, one of the big issues has been that sense of approach avoidance conflict. At some point, there's been this, ooh, I want to do this, but I'm not so sure. I would say if there's any part of you that's like, not sure, red flag, then don't do it. Ask, get information, but likely it's not something to do. There's red flags that we want to be aware of. Things like differences in opinions on the roles of counseling. That would be something to pay attention to. If you and your client are having difference of opinion, oh, I wanted this to happen, but you're doing this. Okay, do we need to refer out? Do we need to clarify what the roles are? I remember there was a situation recently where someone had come into the agency and it became very clear to me after talking with her on the phone about her complaint that she had a very narrow definition of what she was wanting from, quote, marriage counseling with her clinician. But the fact is she never conveyed that. She never said that. She said, oh, but that person didn't do it this way. I wanted this. And so it became clear that there was a difference of opinion of what she thought marriage counseling was. Another red flag, issues like use of space and touch. We need to be very intentional about our distance with our clients, about, you know, how they could interpret that. Again, you could think you're just being nice and kind and personable, but the fact is we don't know the whole narrative. Even if our client's very forthcoming, we don't know their whole narrative of their life. What trauma, what abuse, what touch or space means in their worldview, in their culture, how close or how far away people are supposed to be. Another red flag is being careful not to become too personal. You might think that you're using self-disclosure in a good way, but keep in mind, if it's not something that is really for the benefit of the client, does it really need to be said? And is there another way of getting to that same outcome without giving your example about your life? Also, anytime you have a, quote, special sort of understanding or relationship with a client, that's a red flag. Because if you feel like you're spending more time, you're giving a few extra minutes to this nicer client, but then quick to get the other one out the door that you don't care for, or that you really get this person when other people in his or her life don't, that's something you really need to pay attention to. Another red flag is wavering in your policies and procedures. It's important, as much as possible, be consistent. That's what's going to help you. I'm not saying all your clients will like it. Some may not like it. But if you're charging a fee for missed appointments and whatever, then across the board, do that. I mean, barring emergencies or certain things. Another consideration, a red flag, is are you feeling like you're getting more emotionally attached or more emotionally detached with clients? That could really be telling. What about your scope of practice changing over time and how you deal with people with certain presenting concern, or trying out approaches that are not empirically validated. So things to think of: what factors am I aware of? Are there other areas I need additional information on? What would the board say? What's the context? Remember the one model we talked about? What are the thoughts, beliefs, values in this case? How should I interact with the client? Or what's my role as the counselor? What are my internal perceptions about this case? What goals need to happen here? What is our treatment plan? How would other counselors react to the situation? Who can I consult with? Remember, I said that could be the colleagues in terms of building a scope of practice. That could be the board. But if you have a liability insurance company, they're going to be involved if there is a malpractice suit. So it's useful to make use of what you've paid for to talk with them and consult ahead of time. I remember I had a situation with a borderline that everyone in the community knew. And so I called my liability insurance company because this lady was signing release after release after release, and she jumped through attorneys and community organizations, and, you know, and then she'd change who she was with, and she liked them, then she didn't like them. And the one very useful piece of information my liability insurance company told me, they said, just because you have a release of consent doesn't mean that that release forces you to use it or discuss things. A release doesn't mandate you to actually following through and talking with that person. Other considerations in terms of decision making are, do I know of any precedents in this area? Now, oftentimes, most of us won't always know of that. That's where you probably might want to partner with or pay for a mental health lawyer that could help you look into, oh, yeah, these are the precedents. Also, look at your identity as a person and as a counselor. How does that fit in? What decision-making model have I used or would I use? Can I support my line of reasoning personally, by evidence-based data, or by my scope of practice? What would other clinicians in a similar situation do? And have I brought up these client issues or these issues in general in a staff meeting or a consultation before? Is this documented? I remember a situation where an investigator years ago from the board, that was the first thing she asked me. She said, you know, we were talking about some allegations, and she said, you know, have you talked about this? And I mean, I said, oh, yeah. For staff meetings, we talked about this particular dad and how he'd react and not letting his kids see me or any other staff alone and what he would do. And she's like, okay, I want to make sure you've documented that and that you also documented who was in the staff meeting. You know, what's their name? What were their credentials? And what did they say? I said, oh, yeah, they, you know, said the same thing. They supported. And she's like, okay, then that's something that you need to make sure is written and that's in the chart and stuff and documented. Don't wait until after there's a complaint. Make sure you have a network of those people and you're documenting that ahead of time. So again, as we wrap up this first part, like I said, there's proactive ways from day one, from our first interaction, we can set up an ethical expectation in the agencies we're working at. We can do things like employ Rogers process variables, be genuinely caring, have true empathy, be timely in our feedback to a client, and balanced in terms of both optimism and pessimism. We can have respect for the personhood and the values of this other person. We can test out our own values and make sure that they're not being imposed on a client. we need to go into our situations realizing there's going to be competing ethical standards between ethics, laws, legalities, and all the differences in context and ways we reason it. We talked about some ethical models, including the problem-solving model, the four-quadrant approach, the Tarvitas integrated model, the Catone social constructivism model, and we talked about issues like the principled ethics and principles that we want to be aware of in our decision making. I also gave you some questions to think about in terms of as you're making decisions. And again, remember, if you're having any of that approach, avoidance, conflict at all, or you're not sure, don't act. It's better to just not act until you're sure, until you have those answers that you need. We'll be returning for the second part shortly, and we're going to start to apply some of these basic principles and these decision-making models to a number of different situations and scenarios here.